Good morning, good afternoon, good evening, good day. Just welcome wherever you are listening, whatever time of day it is. Just thank you. I really appreciate you taking the time to listen to my little podcast that comes out every week, sometimes twice a week, that has a conversation about film and music. When Ben and I launched this podcast back in 2016, all we wanted to do was to have a weekly conversation about the beautiful relationship between music and film. Obviously, there was a wish list of people that have been instrumental in both our loves and passions for film and music and that relationship. And I think one of the names that we had on that list way back at the start was Martin Scorsese. Along the way, we've talked about his work extensively. We've had the joy of having his longtime editor, Thelma Schoonmaker, on the podcast. And today, we've finally caught up with our white whale on soundtracking, one of our white whales on soundtracking, as after literally years and weeks of hounding his team, finally managed to get an opportunity to sit down with the one and only Martin Scorsese. Martin joined me to discuss the exceptional, the beautiful, the powerful Killers of the Flower Moon, which is available right now on Apple TV, though we ended up covering so much more than that, from Taxi Driver to Casino, Raging Bull to The Last Waltz. The film was scored by Martin's dear, dear friend and collaborator, the late Robbie Robertson, and we'll begin with his cue, Tribal Council. Talk music, if that's okay.
Sure.
And before we talk about Killers of the Flower Moon, I hope you don't mind if we go back a little while first to, I heard you tell a story about when you were growing up and you were in your apartment and music was almost circling you in a way, in terms of it would come in the windows from other apartments, it would be within your apartment. Do you think it's fair to say that from that point music had a kind of a connection with your imagination?
Well, there's no doubt. I mean, even before that, my father had, it was late 1940s, and they had 78 RPM records and some Latin music from Brazil, but also swing music, Benny Goodman, Artie, and Tommy Dorsey. But primarily it was Django Reinhardt and the Hot Club of France. And so I was about 5 years old, and I listened to these records repeatedly. When I just remember the experience of it and watching the label spin around and looking at the vinyl and watching the needle, and these images would come to mind. They were abstract images and movement, camera, I guess what became camera movement.
Yeah.
And so ultimately, when we moved back to the tenements, we had, for the first few years of my life, we were in a smaller, in a place that was almost like suburbia. Yeah. But then there was a problem. My father had to leave, whatever. And we had to go back to where my father and mother were born, on Elizabeth Street, in these old tenements. And they weren't fashionable the way they are now.
Yeah.
They're very fashionable now. It was a pretty ugly place windows were open all the time, particularly in the summer. Music would come from other people's windows, whether it was opera or swing music or popular music at the time, whether it was Tony Bennett or Sinatra or Patti Page and that sort of thing. And the music I was playing that we had the radio on all the time. And a lot of that time, the radio, the music was, a lot of that music found its way into Irishman, for example.
Yeah.
Desafinado, for example. Music by Nelson Riddle. The instrumental music, themes from movies, the theme from The Barefoot Contessa. All of these things were part of our daily life. Smile by Chaplin. So in any event, right before rock and roll hit, right before 53, a lot of this music was something that just scored our lives.
Yeah.
And I would hear it from different, some of the old Italian people were still, I mean, the older.
Your neighbors.
Yeah. The ones who didn't speak English, who didn't become citizens, and they were dying off in the 60s, but they were still listening to Italian soap operas and Italian music, popular music like Carlo Butti and people like that, and Neapolitan folk songs and Neapolitan love ballads and Neapolitan pieces of music that are very famous now. But we'd hear that all the time.
When you started going to the cinema, did you immediately have a connection with how important the music was in the films that you were seeing and the films that you were experiencing?
Yes, there's no doubt. I think part of it had to do with British cinema. A lot of the Alexander Korda films that were shown on television in the late 40s, the scores were by Miklos Rozsa, and his sound becomes something very, very familiar to me. And of course, he did many great scores in Hollywood. And there was the music of Dmitri Tiomkin, the music for Giant or Land of the Pharaohs, for example, was something that was overwhelming. I think right before Elmer Bernstein came in, there was other music that I heard in movies that stayed with me and made me think that I liked the movie, but instead it really was the mood that was created by the music. And that music was by Bernard Herrmann, invariably. Whether it goes from The Ghost and Mrs. Muir to White Witch Doctor with Robin Mitchum and Susan Hayward to The Wrong Man, Hitchcock, and then, of course,
North by Northwest,
the great scores for the Hitchcock films and other films that Herman did the scores for, Garden of Evil, with Gary Cooper. And so the Herman scores stayed with me longer, I felt. The Rotza, yes, and Tiomkin. Max Steiner scores were basis of Warner Brothers Pictures.
Yeah.
You know, that was something else. That was more almost like the Academy in a way, academic.
Yeah.
They had to be there. It's the famous story of Betty Davis saying to William Wyler, when I walk up those stairs, is it me walking up the stairs or is it Max Steiner? You know what I mean?
Yeah. It's an entrance, isn't it?
Yeah, so, yeah.
I mean,
yeah. But Tiomkin's score for Land of the Pharaohs is an extraordinary score. And giant. It's beautiful.
Which I believe was a bit of an inspiration.
Well, there's no doubt. There's no doubt. Yeah, I happen to be lucky enough to, with my cousin, we went up to see 1955, I think it was. Yeah. Up to the Roxy Theater in New York for the opening night, just to be part of the crowd, to look. I must have been 12 or 13, 12, I think. And somehow, somebody gave him a ticket. It was in the crowd saying, I'm not going to use this. Take it. So he took it, and everybody went into the theater. All these people, it was a major premiere. People were Taylor and Rock Hudson, they were all getting out of the cars, and it was wild. And we were just part of the crowd. And he got this ticket, and so he went over to the usher outside, and the picture had just started. And he said, we came all the way from New Jersey, and we lost our other ticket. Could you go? We didn't come from New Jersey. It was downtown. And we lost him. The guy was looking at us. Yeah, you lost your ticket. He said, all right, go in. Don't worry. And we went in. I walked in, and there it was on the giant screen at the Roxy Theater. And it changed your life. The sense of the epic story, the way Boris Levin's production design changes, the interior of the house changes from mahogany to, as they get older, a white, everything becomes white. The saga of a family. And then, of course, the great James Dean in it. And so that music... in that film was a life-changing experience that night.
When you go on and you work with these people that you cite as being kind of really part of your introduction to film and music, and then you get the chance to work with Bernard, you know, what's that like?
Well, the thing was that I always felt that if I got a chance to make a movie, the movies I would make obviously wouldn't be Hollywood movies, I thought. Well, now they're Hollywood movies, but then they weren't.
Yeah.
I mean, there were movies coming out of independent world in New York that the leaders there were the avant-garde cinema.
Yeah.
Of Brackage and Ed Emshwiller and Al Leslie and all these people.
Yeah.
And then, to name a few, there was Warhol, of course, there was something else. But primarily Cassavetes, who created the films right there in the street with the very lightweight equipment.
Yeah.
And Shirley Clarke, same thing. Cool World and The Connection. Well, The Cool World primarily. And in any event, That made it possible to make these pictures. Therefore, I was making a different kind of film. And therefore, they didn't deserve, I thought, the majesty of the Hollywood score. I love that. There is a majesty to that. Our movies were like marginal. They weren't part of this thing. So how could I have that music in there? So I knew the music that was scoring me was the music I was hearing and the music I was living with, because I saw life scored by Vaughn Monroe and Chuck Berry, Sinatra, and again, Tony Bennett. And I mean, I saw life scored by that, whether it was sides of beef being delivered to the butcher store across the street, or rats being chased by people because you had to kill the rats when you saw them. It was a very, very dirty area. The poor homeless or the drunken guys on the Bowery. In the meantime, Fats Domino is playing when my dream boat comes home. And they're falling on the floor onto the ground.
When my dream boat comes home, and my dream no more wrong, I will meet you and I'll greet you. When my dream boat comes home.
I mean, so this scored my life. And so I put all that together, including Mascagni's Intermezzo, which eventually wound up in Raging Bull.
Yeah.
Some Tchaikovsky. My uncles gave me some 12-inch LPs that were not 33 and a third, but they were still 78. And the Clair de Lune.
Yeah.
And Capriccio Italien and, you know, Caruso singing Ma Paris from Martha and Pagliacci. So I had those besides Benny Goodman, besides all the swing music. And then you had, of course, jazz coming in too. And you had John Coltrane, you had all these others coming in from different parts, Jimmy Smith on organ, and Ahmad Jamal, and that sort of thing I was hearing. But I was more towards popular and what eventually became the rock and roll. Yes. So that scored my life, and I realized that's got to be in the movies. I can't do a movie with a score. So I did that, like Mean Streets is completely scored by my actual 45 RPM.
Yeah, your collection.
My collection has scratches on it and everything. It's great. Yeah. So when it came time to Taxi Driver, I said, this is a character created by Schrader, Paul Schrader. And I said, this guy doesn't listen to music. I said, the only way I think the inner part could be expressed is Bernard Herrmann. I knew at that time Bernard Herrmann was working with Brian De Palma and Dutch filmmakers called Wim Verstappen and Pim de la Pera in Amsterdam. I became friends with them. And they introduced me to Bernard Herrmann. And that was that was the early 70s, because Taxi Driver was made in 75. Mm-hmm. And by that point, I was well aware of the impact his scores had on me. I did design the movie, however. I designed it to Van Morrison's music.
Did you?
Yeah.
Did you know him? Because he obviously later appeared in The Last Waltz.
No, I didn't never met him. Only over the past few years I got to know him a little. And I met him I didn't meet him at The Last Waltz. He just came on stage. And that was it.
Van.
Yeah, Van, the man. Come on, are you kidding? And I know, I mean, when I heard I heard Astral Weeks, and when I heard the group, and then his other albums. But primarily, I liked very much Astral Weeks, of course, Madame George and Like a Ballerina, Slim Slow Sly, and Cypress Avenue, and all these things. His language and his phrasing, sort of between, I guess, James Joyce and Ray Charles somehow mixing together.
Yeah, it's a beautiful way to describe. Such a great storyteller.
Yeah, amazing.
It just transports you.
Yeah.
Yeah,
and suddenly get into a trance-like, very spiritual experience listening to his music, or cleaning windows, all this sort of thing. And so primarily it was T.B. Sheets, which carried me through. And then eventually I used it as an actual score in Bringing Out the Dead.
can't believe that you attempt it to
the car. The cab coming through the steam. Around the harmonica. Come on.
Version of that with that
No. Like it couldn't be. It couldn't be. But the whole sense of the movie is Van doing those blues.
Well, that's really interesting because I heard this one, the absolute joy of chatting to Thelma a few years ago, and we talked quite a lot about, you know, your collaboration and where music as another collaborator comes into it. And also listening to, you know, how beautifully inspirational Paul Pressburger have been to you. The Red Shoes is an example of, you know, that 25 minute scene where
they stopped the movie.
It's the music of Heart Inside. That's not
You don't get it. I mean, that's why I'm sure, well, we said this, that ballet enthusiasts or ballet aficionados are rather annoyed by the film because you don't see very often, you don't see the full figure of the dancer. And don't forget, this goes back to any great dancer on film. Or on a video, a visual medium, Fred Astaire had in his contract that it had to be head to toe.
Did he?
Yes. So if you look at him dancing, there are cuts, but the cut is to another angle, which shows head to toe.
I'm going to go back and watch almost Fred Astaire movies.
Michael Jackson, when I did Bad, had to be very careful to make sure that we saw as much of him as possible. I had to convince him that in certain moments when he spun around, I was going tighter. Yeah. And then we get the feet. And then we go pull back again and show the full figure. Wow. And so, you know, so here you have the Red Shoes and you don't really have that in the ballet sequence. What you have is what she's perceiving, maybe, what she thinks she sees, what she hears when she hears the music, what she's feeling. And the same thing. So I applied that to the fight scenes in Raging Bull.
So incredible.
So you, the guy's in the ring, and I'm telling you, if you get hit a few times with those gloves, you know, they're athletes. You do feel and see differently, and you hear differently.
Yeah.
You know, people don't even know where they are. So you hallucinate, in effect.
Yeah. And a combination of the Red Shoes, but then also working on The Last Waltz and filming, you know, a band like Emmylou Harris, for example, in terms of similarly, we want to see her. You know, it's that kind of thing where you want to, we're not interested in the audience. We're not interested in a close-up.
Oh, no. You see, what happened was that I got involved with some friends of mine at that time in the late 60s. We came out of NYU. Yeah. We were making documentaries, et cetera. We're all working, trying to get a feature made. I met Thelma that way, Thelma Schoonmaker. And we got involved at Woodstock. And at Woodstock, being there 4 days and four nights, whatever it was on the stage, assisting the cameraman, assisting the director. And then in the editing, for the most part, I was part of the editing for the first cut of the picture, and then I was taken off the picture. But the thing about it was that half the film is a three-hour film. Half the film, 90 minutes is music and 90 minutes the audience. And that audience was part of the whole experience, which was an extraordinary experience, to say the least, because everything worked. It could have been disaster.
Yeah.
You know, couldn't even get food. They would bring food down for us. I mean, there were 500,000 people. You couldn't get anywhere. You couldn't move. You couldn't go, like, you were like in prison on stage. The only people, I guess, the acts came in through helicopter, I guess. I don't know. Because the cars, everything was stopped. Everything was stopped. And so I found that the footage of the audience was so complete, so to speak, in the final cut of that film, which I didn't have anything to do with, that if I got to do a music film, and I was approached by John Taplin who produced Mean Streets, to do The Last Waltz, I would not show the audience because I said, let's stay on the stage, let's see what the performers do. How do they work a band? Apparently, the bassist and the drummer are like the motor of. I didn't get any of that. Yeah, and they look at each other and they work this. How do they do all
they
that?
Count.
They count. And let's stay with them. And you know where it really comes from? You should see this great film called Jazz in a Summer's Day.
Okay.
By Bert Stern. It was a great photographer. And he did the Newport Jazz Festival back in the late 50s. And you can get it on DVD, I'm sure. But, you know, he has everybody from Anita O'Day to Louis Armstrong, Jack Teagarden, Chico Hamilton, Jimmy Giuffre. It's jazz, shot in Technicolor, shot in color, I should say, 35 millimeter, and rarely moves the camera. And so you're looking at Chico Hamilton play those drums, and it's an angle from below the drums looking up at him. And you see the relationship from his head, his eyes, to the sticks, to the drum. And as it increases, I say, whoa, this is, why is this so effective? Because I'm looking at them. What do I need to cut to people and cut to lights? And you don't need to. Anita O'Day with her vocalizing is extraordinary. You know, it's the, I think, the essential concert film. There's no doubt about it. And so I decided, let's not show the audience. Yeah. Let's stay on the stage. And then as we didn't even know it was going to be a movie. And then we saw the rushes because I shot it in 35 millimeter, which was an experiment. Usually you shoot those things in 16 because they gave you the freedom to move on stage. But I didn't want that. Here we had, unlike Woodstock, we knew where the band was going to be. And unlike Woodstock or unlike other performers, the band was basically stationary. They didn't move around a lot. So I could place the cameras and I can move the cameras around a bit. And so we had 6-7 cameras and they were all placed very carefully on dollies, etc. You know, I wrote an incredible script to each song. You know, basically it became like an emergency where all the cameras are suddenly broken and we have one more, I need to cover so-and-so, he's going to be singing in the next bit and she's coming out and you got to cover her, that kind of thing. Mm-hmm. But eventually we, at some points during the 6-hour concert, whatever it was, we did run out of coincidentally, what happens is that some cameras ran out of film, some sync motors died. And sure enough, out of the 6 cameras, or the 7th was a handheld, out of the 6 cameras, like 5 of them had gone down. And what was the song? The Wait, the key song. It just happened that way. And so apparently, you know, we got some footage on The Wait. It wasn't very good. And so later, about 6 months into editing the picture, I was working on New York, New York editing. Robbie Robertson said, I think, you know, we'd better redo The Wait. And he said, in which case, maybe we should do this thing called Evangeline too, and bring in Emmylou. And then we could also do the Last Waltz theme at the end. And so we designed that as musical numbers that I did on a soundstage. And those shots that I designed, like, they weren't done with like 3 cameras simultaneously and we did it in the editing. No. If it was the first 4 bars of The Wait, the camera would move from left to right, let's say, and a light would move on, a light would come on behind them. That was the shot. And so that then cut to the next, cut to the next. Mm-hmm. It built to the intercutting of the refrain, the intercutting. If you watch it, the intercutting gets more intense until you put the weight right on me. And that was the design.
I pulled into Nazareth, just feeling about half-assed dead. Just need to find a place where I can lay my head. Mister, can you tell me where a man might find a bed? Just grinned and shook my hand. No was all he said. Take a load off Fanny. Take a load for free. Take a load off Fanny. And you put the load right on me.
And so that was done over a period of a couple of nights. That was then applied to also the boxing scenes in Raging Bull. The punches were like
bars of music, didn't they?
Yeah, the punches were like music. In other words, 4, 3 rights, 1 left, 1 shot. Not 2 cameras, 3 cameras. In some cases, that allowed for, in an interesting way, the Wait and Evangeline were very easy to edit because of that. Whereas the actual concert was, you know, a real editing job. In other words, because you have to catch, but we had it all on stage. And in the case of Raging Bull, in some cases, a few of the fights were very easy to edit. Other fights were not. But even though they were all controlled, there's still something up. Because what happens is that you may design the shot, but then a shot takes on its own life and it becomes something else sometimes. And so in any event, the concept was the same, put it that way.
That was the start of this amazing friendship and collaboration with Robbie, though, in terms of that, that has gone on throughout your career as a filmmaker. And his role has taken on different forms, you know, kind of across different movies, whether it be he writes a score.
Yes, he did originally The Color of Money, for example. You know, the other great composer I worked with was Elmer Bernstein. He was an extraordinary composer for everything. He came a little later. I was more aware of Rotza and Tiomkin and Bernard Herrmann before Bernstein. Bernstein did The Ten Commandments, I think, and Preminger's Man with the Golden Arm. I think the same year.
Same year?
Yeah. Wow. And Man with the Golden Arm is... I mean, and then you hear Ten Commandments and it's beyond Rotza, you know.
And
eventually was lucky enough to work with Elmer a few times. But Robbie did Color of Money and a number of others. But he would also, even if he wasn't doing the actual scoring, let's say in Casino, for example, 3 hours was wall-to-wall
music. So much music.
Yeah.
And also mixing music, like Ginger Baker over.
Well, that was something that Robbie inspired because he told me, don't forget Georges Delerue. And I said, Delerue? Yeah, you mean, he said, yeah, from Contempt, from Le Mépris. And we put it on. Of course, I love that score. And the story between the husband and wife in that is similar to the story of De Niro and Sharon Stone in Casino. And he said, just listen to that. And I said, yeah. And so what I did was I took that and mixed it with Ginger Baker's drum solo, Live Cream on Toad, and brought it in and out throughout the picture. Because the tragic nature of the Delerue really resonated for me. And then I began to realize, why can't we use scores from other movies? You know, I'd love to be able to use the score of King of Kings by Miklos Rotza somewhere.
Yeah.
I have no idea, but I'm just saying.
Yeah. But Thelma says that you almost kind of come in with a kind of musical edit almost of the film.
Well, it's pretty much
so
there.
Much yeah, it's, you know exactly.
No, I know. And very often the scenes are designed to these pieces of music. A lot of the work is done. I kind of lock myself away in a hotel usually, if I can, for like 10 days with a lot of music and then design the shots. But listening to music of different kinds usually builds to that. What I mean by builds to that part of the process.
Yeah.
I don't go in and say, okay, now we're going to listen to music. No, the music is always shuffling around. I hear something. I listen to David Johansen's show. He has a show called A Mansion of Fun that for 3 hours on Sirius XM. And it's so eclectic and goes back to some of the music I use in Killers of the Flower Moon.
What were the conversations you had with Robbie about what you were looking for from him for this particular film?
Well, in this case, in this case, you know, Robbie, I think Robbie is a key factor in me even making this film because I didn't really know Native Americans and met them in the early 70s. I didn't quite know, I was naive and ignorant about the whole thing. I didn't quite get it. But when I got to know Robbie, over the years, I began to understand more and I became more fascinated by the Native. Of course, he's Mohawk, Cayuga, and Jewish from the First Nations outside Toronto. So it's a little different, but the same. And so in this case, I thought it was a culmination of the work he was doing on his own solo albums that he made in the past 20 years. I just got really comfortable with the Native American thinking through him and through others I met over these years. And that kind of led to this movie, actually, in an odd way. I said, you know, first we want the explosion of the oil, and I want to hear those, you know.
So good, that opening piece.
Yeah, and I said, let a rock beat come in there. Don't worry about it. And, of course, a lot of rock and roll is based in Native American music. Link Wray and others were Native Americans, but they changed their names in the 50s. I didn't know that. And so there was a documentary called Rumble that deals with all this, which Robbie's in. I'm in for a few minutes of it. But in any event, I said, I want that edge. And at the same time, I said, you know, dobro guitar. And he said, what about the wailing of the coyotes? Wow.
Yeah.
That's amazing. And wolf calls played on guitar.
And that rhythm.
The rhythm is extraordinary.
Nanu Bakshe. Wahe Yahoba Etra.
And so then the main theme of the picture, I felt that really because the story is between Molly and Ernest, this love story which becomes insidious and dangerous, I said, I need something fleshy and dangerous and sexy and dangerous. And he gave me that in terms of the thumping sound, boom, boom, boom. And it suddenly became, as we were editing, the track that we kept referring to and utilizing. Then I would call him and I'd say, I need more of this kind of thing. And he'd send it, you know. But it was difficult because he lived in L.A. Mm-hmm. and he was ill at the time. And we pulled it together as best we could. And I said, oh, give me some more wolf cries.
Was that line where says he looks like a coyote?
Yeah, I want a coyote. Give me a coyote. It's a
it's wonderful that he's getting, you know, such praise for this last piece of work.
I miss him terribly, I tell you. The last 10 years of our lives, he stayed in L.A., I was in New York, but we'd see each other. But, you know, it was like pretty much like a family, like a brother.
Yeah.
Very, very unique. And the damn voice was great, just the way he spoke.
Yeah.
And he was so cool and get me so angry. Get me some men.
Effortlessly cool.
I'd be jumping up and down screaming and he'd be like.
I love that. That's where two opposites attract, you see.
Yeah.
Totally.
And then at one point I told him, you're trying to calm me down, aren't you? I said, no, I'm not.
Oh, listen, I could talk to you for hours and I didn't even get a chance to talk to you about the Clash who you wanted to have.
Oh, I wanted to have my guys. I wanted them in Gangs of New York.
Yeah.
You know. I wanted their music. I wanted to score the picture. The film wasn't made at that time.
Yeah.
Maybe it's too bad. Maybe I don't know if I could have made it at that time. Yeah. It just didn't happen.
I'm going home to put on Taxi Driver and play Van Morrison in the background.
TB Sheets.
Okay. Yeah.
Foreign Bodies.
Okay.
You hear him say Foreign Bodies. Yeah. You know, okay. Turn up the radio. Turn up the radio. You want to open the window? Open the window. That's right. You know, a couple of friends are coming over a little later. Do you listen to the lyrics?
I can see it though when you're saying it, totally.
Yeah.
Oh, thank you for your time.
Thank you. Thank you. It was really great.
Yeah, it's so great to chat to you. Thank you so much.
You too.
Yeah, have a great day.
From the score to Killers of the Flower Moon, that's They Don't Live Long by Robbie Robertson, rounding off this latest episode of Soundtracking with Martin Scorsese. My huge thanks to Martin for taking the time to talk to me. Also, huge shout out to Scott and the whole team who made this happen. Killers of the Flower Moon is available to watch on Apple TV, so get yourself signed up to that if you haven't already. And if you see the opportunity to watch it in the big screen, please go and do that. I had a great chat with Martin's longtime editor, as I mentioned at the start of the episode, Thelma Schoonmaker, on the podcast, which you can find at edithbowman.com, along with all of our previous episodes. There are loads of Scorsese fans among my guests, as you'd imagine, so you can hear him talked about throughout many episodes. Follow us on socials. We are at Soundtracking UK, and we also have a YouTube channel where I'll be popping up the video of my chat with Martin. Next up, we've got a lovely kind of double header of something old and something new. Laura Cartman is an incredible musician and film composer, and she most recently composed the music for American Fiction, a phenomenal film that's been quite rightly nominated for many awards on this side and across the pond. And then celebrating the anniversary of, for me, which was a really important film in my kind of film fan journey, City of God, director Fernando Mireles joins us to talk about City of God. So we have Laura and Fernando on next week's episode. I very much look forward to the pleasure of your company then.